This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. News Corp Chairman Rupert Murdoch returned to the London newsroom of one of his favorite papers today. The Sun is the second Murdoch-owned tabloid to find itself mired in scandal, and he was there to reassure staffers fearful for its future. As NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik reports, Murdoch says he is doubling down on newspapering despite growing legal troubles.
The good news for The Sun first. It will stay in business, and it will soon be joined by The Sun on Sunday, a new tabloid for the weekend. Simon Jenkins used to work for Murdoch as editor of The Times of London.
He needed to come to reestablish morale at what was a desperately depressed headquarters.
Murdoch toured The Sun newsroom with his older son, Lachlan, like visiting royalty, according to those present, spending a few hours meeting with small groups of employees around the office. He sought to quell a brewing newsroom insurrection. People there had been reeling from an internal investigation that led to the arrests of 10 Sun journalists on suspicion of bribing public officials. Murdoch lifted some spirits by putting those who were arrested back on the payroll, offering to pay legal fees and lifting their suspensions, at least until they face actual criminal charges. There is only space for The Sun on Sunday because News Corp shut down its tainted Sunday tabloid News of the World last summer after the eruption of the phone hacking scandal. Arrests have reached the top tiers of executives for the company's British newspaper division. But Simon Jenkins suggests a second motivation for the 80-year-old press baron's announcement today.
He's determined to show he's still in charge. He's not the rather doddery old man who appeared at the parliamentary inquiry a few months ago.
Yet for all of his rallying the troops, Murdoch also stood by the company's internal investigation, saying illegal activities simply cannot and will not be tolerated. Earlier in the week, Sun Associate Editor Trevor Kavanaugh had angrily denounced the extent to which that inquiry had shared material with the police.
This police operation is wildly disproportionate with what might be the potential offences that may or may not have been committed. You have 171 officers who are involved in three separate operations, and this is the biggest single police operation in the history of British policing.
Even reporters at Murdoch's prestigious newspapers shared those concerns. At the Times of London, an incident of computer hacking by a reporter is under investigation. Two distinguished British lawyers are preparing a possible legal challenge, saying the company's collaboration with police was stripping journalists of their right to protect their sources and methods. But Murdoch biographer Michael Wolff says this new investigative tack into bribery could prove far more damaging than the inquiry into hacking into phone voicemail messages, itself initially dismissed as an isolated case.
This is corrupting the system. So we're beyond rogue reporters. We're beyond even countenancing rogue reporters. We're into a level in which we take a business and we say it's going to undermine law and order.
Among those also arrested over the past week were an active duty member of the British Armed Forces, a police officer, and an employee of the Ministry of Defense. Publicly traded American companies can be criminally prosecuted for bribing public officials abroad. Defending the paper makes it harder for News Corp executives to prove to British and American authorities that they're taking those allegations seriously. Hence, Wolf says, Murdoch's dilemma.
Of all the executives, I think there's only one person who really steadfastly and in his heart wants to maintain The Sun and the British operation, and that's Rupert Murdoch. I think for everyone else, it would make their lives so much easier, not to mention it would make this company so much more valuable were he to walk away from the British operation.
News Corp's future lies in television and entertainment, but for years the British papers, and especially The Sun, served as a power base and a driver of profit. Notably absent from today's visit to the London newsroom was News Corp's chief executive over the UK, Europe, and Asia. That would be James Murdoch, Rupert's younger son, and until recently, his presumed heir apparent. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You probably know that smog is bad for you and you could just feel it. But the effects of air pollution can go way beyond damaging your lungs, right to your brain, possibly speeding up memory loss, sort of making your brain age faster, or upping your risk of stroke if you're out on an especially smoggy day. That's the conclusion of two studies published this week in the Archives of Internal Medicine. Jennifer Weave is an assistant professor of medicine at Rush Institute for Healthy Aging at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago. She's one of the study authors, and she joins us. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Weave.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon, Ira.
I can't believe the conclusion that that smog is also bad for your brain.
Yeah, it's sort of surprising, isn't it?
Yeah. How does that mechanism work?
Right. Yeah, you know, our study wasn't really designed to examine the mechanism closely, but we have two mechanisms in mind. One is this intriguing evidence, actually it's pretty much conclusive now, that exposure to particulate air pollution is associated with cardiovascular disease risk. And that risk itself may have a role in affecting cognitive decline and dementia.
Hmm.
The second mechanism we're interested in is a little bit more direct. Several studies have found that some of these particles that are in the air, like what we see in smoke and smog and maybe particles we can't even see, that some of these particles can actually get into the brain. And once they're there, they can cause inflammation, which may be involved in the pathogenesis or progression of dementia. And these particles might even trigger some of those microscopic changes like the deposition of beta amyloid plaques that are typical of Alzheimer's disease.
Wow. And how do they get into your brain from your nose or your lungs?
Sure. I think that's a legitimate question. Sure.
Yeah.
They may get there in a couple of ways, and it sort of depends on how large or small they are. Particles can get into our body, obviously, through inhalation, and some of those particles make it down to the lung, where they can cross the barrier between the lung and the blood and enter circulation, and then from there make their way up into the brain. Some small particles can literally go from the nasal passage, attached to the olfactory nerve ending in the nasal passage, travel up the axon, and get into the brain that way. Not all particles can do that, but there is some pretty convincing animal evidence that is certainly possible.
Mm-hmm. Your studies did not, as you say, you did not study the mechanism by how this is happening, but you studied the statistical correlation.
Yes, we sure did.
And give us some of the thumbnails that you discovered there.
Yeah, sure. So kind of starting from the overview level, our study explored exposure to particulate air pollution over the long term, over many years, and how that relates to decline in cognitive functioning among older women. And we've already talked about particulate air pollution, and so I'm going to move on a little bit. The most important finding of our study is that women who were exposed to higher levels of particulate matter in the air over the long term experienced more decline in their cognitive functioning over the 4 years that we evaluated them. This was true, interestingly enough, for two kinds of particulate air pollution that we studied. One is a smaller form of particles called fine particulate matter, and those are particles that are less than 2.5 microns in diameter, which is 1/30th the width of a human hair. That wasn't so surprising to us, although it was nice to see it in the data. What was surprising to us is that we also saw this association with what's called coarse particulate pollution. And those coarse particles are a little bigger. They're 2.5 to 10 microns in diameter. Certainly not golf ball size by any stretch. but we were surprised to see an association with exposure to this form of particulate air pollution as well. And I just want to say that exposure to these two kinds of particulate air pollutions are not always correlated with each other. So just because a person is exposed to a high level of fine particulate matter doesn't mean that they're also exposed to high levels of coarse particulate matter.
Mm. And what would be the source of the particulate matter? Is it soot? Is it exhaust? Is it smokestacks or all of those?
You've clearly been studying this. Yeah, sure. Essentially from burning things. It could be burning wood. It could be burning fuels, burning coal. Another source of dust, however, or of particles, is dust, and that dust can come from agricultural sources. It can come from forest fires, And it can also come from industrial processes such as crushing or grinding operations, which is also how we get dust in rural areas when we think of trucks going up gravel roads.
Now, is this a lifelong exposure, or could you be on a really dusty road or in a heavy smog one day, and that really will have an effect on you too?
Right. You know, we weren't really able to explore that in our study because of how it was designed. However, the study of ischemic stroke looked at that much more directly. And in fact, that's what makes these two studies very complementary. Essentially, they were looking at the acute effects of being exposed to high particle days and found that if you were exposed to a day of high air pollution, and we're talking about high air pollution, it wasn't even that high, it was higher than low, mm-hmm. that you were at higher risk of ischemic stroke. And certainly we think of stroke or this sort of cerebral vascular disease process as being important and highly relevant to the process of cognitive decline. But we were more interested in these long accruals of exposure.
Hmm. So does that mean that you think there might be, as where the population is aging and we're able to better diagnose, having mental diseases, that air pollution might have something to do with it more than we think it might?
Well, I think it's probably helpful to put our results in perspective. The way that we reported our results is we reported the difference in the rate of cognitive decline over time for each additional 10 micrograms per meter cubed increment in particulate matter exposure. Now, that sounds really fancy. That difference is as if you were comparing the average exposure in Boston to Chicago, for example. Certainly not every place in Boston is the same, mm-hmm. not every place in Chicago is the same, and not every day is the same. But that kind of gives you a sense of the difference we're talking about. So if we took two women in our study who were alike in every single way except that one had an exposure to particulate matter air pollution that was 10 units higher than the other, it was as if that higher exposed woman was 2 years older at her baseline cognitive assessment. So we're talking kind of the order of aging 2 years with this higher exposure. Now, that doesn't seem like much on an individual basis. You wouldn't go to your doctor and be evaluated, and your doctor would not frown at you and say, oh, no, you are acting 2 years older than you should be. Well, if you were a four-year-old, that might be a problem.
Right.
But if you're a 71-year-old, it wouldn't be a big deal. But, it's helpful to think about this on a population basis. And these results, if they are valid, if they're confirmed in other studies, they could be important. Mm-hmm. Imagine that we successfully reduce everyone's exposures to particulate matter air pollution. Now, there will be some people who are at zero, but most of us have a pretty measurable level of exposure. Now, that means that these people will experience slower cognitive decline over time, meaning that fewer people will reach their threshold of dementia during their lives,
mm-hmm.
and affiliated families and society will bear less of a burden due to this condition. So that's nice, but we can put this in a more quantified perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And based on the work of some other scientists who about over 10 years ago made this really interesting forecast, which is that if we had an intervention that we could apply to everyone, say through air pollution policy, for example, and that this intervention delays the onset of Alzheimer's disease, the most common type of dementia, by 2 years, we could reduce the number of cases in the United States of dementia. Not the United States of dementia, but we reduce the number of cases of dementia in the United States.
We get it.
By about 2 million people over the coming 40 years. So, so we're talking about interventions that have a big effect overall,
even
if we can't see them on an individual level.
One last question. In your sure. consideration of particles, can you move nanoparticles into this?
Yeah, that's a great question, and certainly relevant to the increased use of nanoparticles in manufacturing and in our personal care products as well. We have a follow-up study to examine exposure to what's called black carbon. These are the particles that consist of carbon, obviously, but generally they're smaller, and they're emitted through the burning of diesel fuel. And we're certainly interested to see what those look like. And it's certainly one of many future areas for exploration.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today. We're certainly going to look for nanoparticles because, as you say, they're ubiquitous. They're everywhere, and that's sort of something I think you'd have to include somewhere along the line.
Yeah, yeah. So the trick will be measuring. So wish us luck on that.
Well, details, right?
Yes, exactly. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Weave. Jennifer Weave is Assistant Professor of Medicine at the Rush Institute for Healthy Aging at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago.
Throughout this Black History Month, we have been digging into recent memoirs by African Americans. We've noticed there seems to be a fresh zeal to explore family history. Today, we want to highlight the personal journey of one of our own colleagues, NPR producer John Asante. He shares his story of making his first visit to Ghana, the birthplace of his parents.
When most people are asked the question, "So, where are you from?" the response is pretty straightforward. You typically respond with a city or a state or a country. From there, you gauge how much more about your past you want to divulge. I used to struggle with the question, choosing to respond with Atlanta or Georgia, where my mom lives now, even though I grew up and spent more time in the Northeast. But if I feel really comfortable with the person asking, I'll say Ghana. Yep, that's where my family originates, mom's side and dad's side. Until fairly recently, however, I had never been to Ghana. I grew up knowing that I'm Ghanaian-American. From the food, to the customs, to the languages, which I actually understood and spoke a bit as a child. Yet my sense of being Ghanaian only went so far. To bridge that distance in my soul, I knew I needed to connect with my roots. And in late September, after months of planning, I made my first trip to Ghana. Unforeseen circumstances prevented my mother and my sister from accompanying me on the journey. We had planned to pay tribute to my father, John Kofi Beidou Asante Sr. He passed away 21 years ago when I was just 3 years old. So I made the trek to Accra alone. I met loads of relatives who showed me unconditional love from the moment I stepped inside their modest homes. I was offered my favorite foods, fufu, kenke, jollof rice, the works. I traveled through the markets of Accra and I tried to take in all this West African nation had to offer during my 2 week vacation. Even though Ghana is a pretty progressive country, the first sub-Saharan African nation to gain independence, mind you, I had a bit of culture shock. I was startled by the haggling system when taking a cab, and the hawkers on the street selling plantain chips and maps of the country. Complicating matters, I didn't speak Twi or Fanti well enough to get by. So the second I opened my mouth, my natural camouflage was of no use. I never felt like I was in danger, especially with my cousins and uncles serving as tour guides, but I did feel defeated. I guess you only recognize just how American you are when you're in another country. The most difficulty I faced was the reason I went to Ghana in the first place, to learn more about my father. Here's what I knew. He grew up in a small village in the eastern region of Ghana, emigrated to New York City in the late 70s, and earned a degree in accounting from Baruch College. He worked as an accountant by day and ran his own laundromat in the Bronx by night. Along the way, he met and married my mother, started a family, and was gunned down by a young drug dealer one cold, dark night in January 1991. 4 kids and a young wife were left without the patriarch of the household. His body was then returned to his native land. So when I made the lengthy, rocky, 5-hour car ride with my uncle and aunt to my father's birthplace of Swabe, I would also see his resting place. But when I arrived at his grave, the tears didn't flow like long rivers the way they did from my relatives. I was silent. My heart was beating fast. Joined by the other family members in Swabe, we formed a circle around the ornate 7-foot gravestone made of concrete and pebbles, and my uncle led a group prayer. Then I read the inscription my mother had placed beneath my father's name. "Eternal rest grant unto him, O Lord, and let the perpetual light shine upon him. Rest in peace." Though I was sad, I was at a loss for expression or emotion. Perhaps we came upon the grave so quick that I couldn't prepare myself. But how do you prepare for that moment? It's still something I think about today. My mother offers encouragement, telling me that I made the effort, and that's all we can ask for. Now, when people ask, "So, where are you from?" I tell them without hesitation, "I'm from Ghana."
That was John Asante, a producer here at NPR, sharing memories from his first trip to Ghana.
So a Santorum surge and a Romney slump in Michigan. Go figure. Here to make sense of the political week is E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post. Hi, E.J.
Good to be with you.
And filling in for David Brooks today, we have Ramesh Panuru, senior editor at the National Review. Welcome back, Ramesh.
Thank you.
Let's start with you. To add insult to injury today, one of Mitt Romney's top supporters in Ohio, the state attorney general, former Senator Mike DeWine, flipped. He switched his endorsement to Rick Santorum. Do you think the Romney campaign is in freefall?
I think it has been a bad several weeks now for Governor Romney's campaign, and the DeWine news is just the latest bit of bad news that they've had. And I think it's pretty clearly a reflection of the fact that Romney is doing so poorly.
How do they turn it around?
Well, it's not clear. There has been resistance from conservatives to Romney all the way through, and that is why he has always been an extraordinarily weak frontrunner. And in Rick Santorum, he is facing in some ways the toughest challenger he's ever had. He's somebody who doesn't have the baggage of Newt Gingrich, doesn't have the lack of experience of Herman Cain. It's going to be a real problem for him.
E.J., we heard in Ari Shapiro's story that Mitt Romney is in danger of losing his home state, Michigan. It's the state his father served as governor. It should be a gimme, most people would say. I want to play some tape. This is by way of illustrating that the trouble that Romney seems to have connecting. This is him before a Chamber of Commerce yesterday in Michigan.
A little history. I was born and raised here. I love this state. It seems right here. The trees are the right height. I like seeing the lakes. I love the lakes. There's something very special here. The Great Lakes, but also all the little inland lakes that dot the parts of Michigan. I love cars. I don't know.
And it goes on for quite some time. E.J., what do you make of that? Is it emblematic of the Romney enthusiasm problem we've been talking about?
Can I just say, I love NPR because these microphones are of a perfect size. I've never seen a more perfectly sized microphone in my life. What a weird week he has. You know, he's had we're quoting all these lines that he was a severely conservative governor. Has the word severely ever gotten such careful analysis? And I use the word weird, and you may recall that some months ago, the Obama campaign let it out that quietly that they were going to present Romney as weird, and then they got a lot of pushback. These responses of his are feeding that very sense. And again, this view of him totally contrasts with what people who've worked with him in business say he is. Mm-hmm. They say he can be a warm person. But in public, he has been so awkward, and he hasn't seemed to learn as the campaign has gone on. It's, in fact, gotten worse.
The fight over contraception and religious institutions is continuing. And today, a number of Democratic women senators took to the floor. They were condemning what they call an attack on women's health care by Republicans. And several of them mentioned a hearing yesterday, a photo out of that hearing showing an all-male panel of religious leaders and professors. It was a hearing on government-required health coverage for contraception. Ramesh, the Republican chairman, Daryl Issa, says it's religious liberty, not contraception, that's at issue. Do you think women voters are going to see it that way, or do they have a problem here?
Well, I think that is the big question about the politics of this issue. If it is defined as some people on the left are calling it, a war on contraception by the Republicans, then I think you do have the potential to mobilize not just women, but a lot of voters who are obviously not going to be for something like that. On the other hand, if it is seen as a war on religious liberty by the administration, the way the Republicans are looking at it, you could have a problem with Catholic voters, among others.
E.J.?
That was really one of the dumbest moves the Republicans have ever made. When you put together a panel like that, there are plenty of religious women out there who agree with the Republicans. They're going to put one woman on the panel. Not only that, they bounced the Democratic woman who is a third-year law student at Georgetown and said, well, this is not relevant because she wants to talk about contraception. As long as Obama was stuck where he was before he reached this accommodation, they really had a religious liberty case. It switched now to a contraception case. But Obama still has to be careful. He's got to be true to his word as he negotiates. Even if the bishops keep pushing back hard, and I think excessively, he's got to make that deal stick. But right now, the issue is totally flipped in a week.
Let's end by talking about the payroll tax bill that's headed to the president now. Today, Congress passed the package. It includes the payroll tax cut, also an extension of jobless benefits, and it puts off the scheduled pay cut for doctors who treat Medicare patients. Ramesh, a template here for future bipartisan agreement, do you think, or an anomaly that will not be repeated?
Well, I think it is an anomaly because here you have a situation where Republicans were resisting a tax cut and Democrats were pushing them to continue it, and that is not a situation that happens happens normally. I think if the Republicans had been put themselves in the position of being blamed for a big tax increase, that would have been a serious problem for the Republicans. They understood that eventually, and that's why you got the deal you did.
And you have the congressional approval rating, what, in negative digits at this point now, EJ?
Right. The Republicans, I think this is a sign of Republican weakness, even though they did get some concessions out of that. A lot of Democrats did not like this burden on new federal employees on pensions, and I think it's a dumb idea for a lot of reasons. But the Republicans knew, as Ramesh said, that they could not be seen as tax raisers. This is the first kind of normal negotiation you've had in the Congress in a long, long time. And it may be a sign that Republicans may start to be accepting that perhaps President Obama is going to get reelected, and maybe we should do some deals with him now, so we will too.
We'll have to leave it there. E.J. Dion of the Washington Post and Brookings Institution, Ramesh Panuru of the National Review, also a columnist for Bloomberg View. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
You know it's Oscar campaign season when Brad Pitt and George Clooney and Meryl Streep all appear on NPR programs some weeks after their Oscar-nominated movies were released. Some films that haven't been in theaters for months suddenly reappear, with primetime trailers touting their nominations. And in Los Angeles and New York, there's no end to the free screenings for Academy members, rare FaceTime with the stars and filmmakers, and the gaudy full-page ads in The Times, both of them, and the trade magazines. Call it the Oscar Industrial Complex. Joining us now is Christy Gross, the awards editor for Variety, to talk about this. And first of all, Christy, when do the polls close, and who has the vote here?
The polls close next Tuesday, February 21st, and ballots need to be completed and in the hands of the Academy's accounting firm, PricewaterhouseCoopers, by 5 p.m. that day. But the people who vote on the Academy Awards, it's about a group of a little bit less than 6,000 entertainment professionals. It's an invitation-only group of people. They're all people who work now or have worked in the business across all different disciplines, whether it's sound mixing, acting, directing, screenwriting, those types of disciplines.
And I take it that the very fact that Variety has a job like yours, being the awards editor, proves that this is an institution. This is a big deal.
Yeah, it is a big deal, and I think that the Academy goes out of its way every year to acknowledge and accept the fact that campaigning is going to go on, but to make sure that it happens in a way that maintains the integrity of the award. That's why every year you see rule changes and tweaking of what you can and can't do throughout the season to promote your film to Academy members.
This time last year, Best Supporting Actress nominee Melissa Leo caused a stir by taking out her own ads in the Hollywood trade magazines, one of her in a faux fur coat standing beside a swimming pool. The ads were panned, but she won. Is it assumed that she might have turned some votes with that?
You know, it's funny because there are examples of that nearly every year since the Academy Awards began. I mean, Mary Pickford famously had Academy members to pick fair her lovely house in Bel Air for tea to convince them that they should vote for her for Best Actress for Coquette. So it's kind of funny, but I think that it just depends. You can't say for certain that kind of thing really changes people's minds. I mean, there is sort of an adage about how you can make people see movies, but you can't make them like them, and you can't make them vote for them.
I understand, though, that the Academy did some campaign reform this year. The rules are a little bit different?
They are a little bit different. And, for instance, one of the other things that happened last year was Julia Roberts hosted a private screening for Beautiful, the Javier Bardem foreign language film. And the film at that time hadn't really gotten a lot of momentum going in the award circuit. And, you know, she was in the press saying that she was so enthusiastic about this performance. And he ultimately ended up getting an Academy Award nomination for the performance. So even though what she was doing at the time, there was nothing at all that was against the rules in what she was doing. And it was really some, you know, out of love for her co-star's performance that she did the screening. But it also led to the Academy saying that no Academy members can host a screening and they can't endorse a performance in order to sway voters, basically.
I gather Harvey Weinstein is considered the father of the modern Oscar campaign. Fair enough?
I think that's definitely a fair assessment, yes.
What are his great successes?
Well, I mean, just look at last year with The King's Speech. You know, I think that he knows that it's not done until the ballots are in PricewaterhouseCoopers' hands. And for that reason, he's able to ignore the criticism. He's able to come up with creative ways to promote his films. He's able to stay on message throughout any leg of a campaign. And last year with King's Speech, that film, it hadn't swept all the precursor awards the way that The Social Network had. So, you know, even though it didn't get all those awards, he was able to keep it top of mind for voters and take it to a Best Picture win.
Well, Christy Gross, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Christy Gross is the awards editor for Variety.
You are listening to All Things Considered.